All right, guys, episode 16 of Strength Academy. Today we talk about how to apply a healthy dose of skepticism to content online related to weightlifting and nutrition, and then we discuss how we got into philosophy and why that's important.
All right, everybody, welcome to another episode of Strength Academy. Mundo here with, once again, Grayson.
How's it going, everybody?
All right, so we have a couple things going on, and we had some questions we were asking ourselves, and it turned into an interesting topic. And what did you think about, Grayson?
I have a couple things that I want to go over before we get into the meat of today's topic. I wanted to give a shout out to one of our lifters, Angelica. She just took first place in a bikini figure competition out in Arizona this weekend. She competed at the AO3 just 2 months ago. So within 2 months, she did her first higher level kind of, you know, lifting on a big stage in front of a crowd, and then turned right around and went back and did another figure competition. And she did awesome. She took home, I think, 4 trophies from different categories that she was entered in. And that was really awesome to see, and to see that, you know, weightlifting and, you know, doing heavy or low rep stuff can really help the package that you bring to those kind of physique shows. So congratulations, Angelica. We're looking forward to getting you back in the gym to do a little bit more weightlifting. I'm sure that you're so hungry. You've done an awesome job.
Congrats, Angelica.
So, Mundo, I have a confession.
Okay.
I went to hot yoga yesterday.
Okay. Okay.
I hadn't gone to, like, any organized fitness class in so long. And I was like, what am I going to do? I thought I was going to go to a concert last night, but it ended up being Friday night, and I just don't know what dates are.
Oh.
Okay. So, I was like, well, what am I going to do instead? So I went out there, and it was a weird experience. One, I think that after having done a lot of weightlifting for a long time and a lot of corrective exercises like bird dogs and some working on flexibility, when people tell you that hot yoga is the hardest thing that they've ever done, they've never done weightlifting.
Yeah.
Like, it was tiring, and I was I was sweating a lot and fell over a couple times. But as far as the grueling nature of it, it's really not as bad as people say, especially when you compare it to 3 hours of snatching or whatever it is that you're doing. So that was kind of an interesting experience. I've been wanting to... I've been having some trouble holding myself accountable to my nightly stretching routine. So I kind of wanted to try changing something up and doing something a little more aggressive with the mobility work. And I had a good time with it, man. It was real weird. I got to practice some of my Wim Hof breathing exercises in the, you know, rebound end of the class, which, super dizzy doing that in 100 degrees. But it was a weird thing. I can see why some people like to kind of supplement some of their training with going to an occasional yoga class, because stretching on your own, you'll do it. But I would have never done that to myself, because it was kind of awful.
I've done hot yoga a couple times before, and I don't think it's difficult. It's just uncomfortable in a different way, because you're just so sweaty. You just feel gross. Like, your feet are slipping off the mat. Like, it's hard to stay stabilized. You're just dripping everything from everywhere. And, I mean, they put this mirror in front of you, so you're just, like, trying not to stare at anybody else. But then there's people in front of you and then to the side of you. There's just, like, no way of it not being unawkward at any point.
The whole thing was very, very strange. It was just really out of my element.
But it
definitely made me appreciate, you know, having a practice session rather than a class. That's the setup that we have at the gym, and it just made me really appreciate that it's not let's turn 30 people through in an hour and have a guy with a headset cheer you on and, you know, relax your toes like an hour. Like, I really, it made me really appreciate the amount of individual attention we get to spend with everybody that comes through our gym.
Yeah.
And just made me appreciate that we actually get time to talk to people and let them work at their own pace. And we're not having people falling off and not keeping up.
Right.
It kind of, it really affirmed the idea of having practice rather than classes for me, I guess.
Yeah, no, I've been to ones where it's just a class and they're, it's like a guided, you know, yoga, class, and you just see people, everybody can't do the same things. Like, not everybody can hold a position for that long or even get into the position that they're intending. And, I don't know, you don't get a whole lot of individual attention. You really don't. It's just somebody, if they do get up and walk around, they're just making sure that you haven't passed out yet from the heat. So
it definitely seemed like it was, you conscious? Cool. Yeah. Cool.
You alive? But, yeah, I mean, it's not a totally, fix all for, you know, doing your stretching and things like that, but it's definitely a different way to go about it for sure.
Yeah. So if you need to spice up your, you know, mobility routine or just kind of do something out of the ordinary, because sometimes it's just kind of fun to go and do something you haven't done before. So that was kind of an interesting afternoon. But I think our main bulk of our conversation today is we're just going to talk about how to look at information and content that you find on the internet and evaluate whether or not it's worth listening to. And what makes it so hard is that there's a lot of different ways to do things. So just because two people aren't agreeing about something doesn't mean that either of them are wrong. There's a lot of gray area within things. But we were thinking a lot about people that offer nutrition services on platforms like Instagram or Facebook. And I would say the first thing to really look out for if you are looking for dietary advice is that people think that the word nutritionist has some sort of licensing or backing to it. But a nutritionist, isn't actually a word. If you want, like, so someone, anyone can call themselves a nutritionist.
Really?
Yeah. Okay. Because it's not a real, like, institutionalized standard. So if you're looking for real professional help with your nutrition, you need to look for a registered dietitian. That's a person with a PhD.
Okay.
Well, or a master's. It's one of the two. But they have post-secondary education, a bachelor's in nutrition, and then it went on to a PhD to do nutrition counseling. A nutritionist can be someone who took one class at a community college, read the RP book, and then started selling diet templates on Instagram.
Okay.
So, like, it's really hard because nutritionist sounds like a really, you know, it sounds certified. It sounds like a thing.
Legit, right?
But really, anybody can call themselves that.
So that's like your uncle growing weed in his basement and calling himself a botanist.
Exactly. That's 100% it. So that's something to really watch out for. And, you know, because a lot of these people that are calling themselves nutritionists are, you know, sometimes I've seen diet plans handed out to people that are like 1300 calories and it's all broccoli and chicken breast and it's, you know, just kind of basic stuff, super calorie deficit. And yeah, I mean, you're going to lose weight, but that person isn't trained to think about what vitamins and minerals you need throughout the day. That person's not, you know, certified to deal with any, you know, diseases or illnesses that you have or food insensitivities. They don't know half of what a registered dietitian would know, and then what they know could be very different. So the problem with the nutritionist is some of them might actually be awesome. Some of them might be really well read, well versed.
Sure.
But some of them might not be. So if you feel like, you know, you've reached out to somebody and you're getting like a cookie cutter, like they're just sending this same Excel spreadsheet to everybody and saying that they're doing it for you, that's something I'd look out for.
So how do you tell the difference, like when you are getting something like that? So let's say I come across somebody on Instagram that, like, if I wanted to do like a bodybuilding show, and I wanted to reach out to somebody that maybe has done bodybuilding shows before, how do I know what they're doing is legit and they're not just taking the template that somebody else gave them and then selling it to people that are asking them for the same thing?
I'd say there's probably a couple things that you want to look for in that situation. I mean, one would be look at their resume of who they're actually working with, and if they're working with anybody that's actually doing well at the thing you want to do. So if they're, you know, if you're trying to go to a high level and, you know, do a bodybuilding show and place well, and it's somebody that's mostly worked with, I just need to lose 5 pounds, kind of just general weight loss stuff, then that might not be the best. But I would say, like, intake questions. So, like, if you say, hey, I want to lose weight and diet for a show, and the next response is, give me my money and I'm going to send you this template, and you just get it right then, that's sort of a red flag to me. Because you need to do a lot more assessment. So if you're working with someone for that and they haven't really asked you, well, what does your normal eating look like? What are you eating right now? And they don't try to get a baseline for your calorie level or what types of foods you eat or when you eat or what things have worked well in the past, or, you know, questions outside of how tall are you and how much do you weigh?
Yeah.
You know, like, how many hours a week are you training? What does that training look like? So I'd say that if you're not getting, you know, detailed questions about what you're doing, you're probably not getting a personalized service. Right. If they don't know anything about you.
And that makes sense. I don't know if you've ever bought a new car before, but if you just show up to the dealership and say, oh, well, I want a new car, and they're going to be like, okay, well, what do you use it for? Like, do you have a family? Is it just you? How much, you know, how much are you going to drive it? What kind of activities are you interested in? You know, so if you want a sporty, fast, something small that, you know, you can drive every day, they're not going to try to sell you a truck. You know, they're not going to be like, well, all we have is trucks here, so why don't you buy this truck instead? That's kind of, you know, the idea with some of these templates and things. Like, the one size fits all, it's like you showing up to the parking lot saying, well, I kind of want this, and they're just like, well, we have all these, they're all black, and you can pick any one of those, and it probably suit your needs. So, but it, I mean, it's not the case. Like, you have to go in knowing what you want. Like, if you want to lose weight, right, it's for a competition. This is the kind of things you can or cannot eat. If you have allergies, you know, if there's problems with keeping weight on or off because you retain water, and they'll, like you said, they're going to ask you a lot of questions, or they should be asking you a lot of questions. Because if something's tailored to you, they're going to have to know what you can, cannot have, things that are going to affect you in an adverse or positive way. I think that's one of the telltale signs, is like, how much are they interested in you as opposed to just giving you a product that they're selling?
Yeah, I think that's definitely a really good point across the board, in that if you want some, like, it's just so easy for people to fake it these days. Because if you post a lot and you promote your posts and you yourself are in pretty good shape, people will just assume that you know what you're doing because it's worked for you.
Right.
But that doesn't necessarily carry over. Where it gets a little more complicated than nutrition, because I think nutrition, there's some people doing good things, but it's really easy to tell who's a dietitian and who's a nutritionist, you know, and who's being thorough and who's just kind of essentially selling you something that you could do the math for yourself in 15 minutes.
Right.
And that's the thing, is if you go get your BMR calculated on just any internet free calculator website, you can factor in your activity and then factor in your macros from there and have a and get essentially the same thing that you're getting from those people if you just read for 15 minutes and did a little bit of math.
Yeah.
And I think it's, I don't know, it's kind of taking advantage of people.
And it really is. It's, unfortunately, somebody out there is going to buy it because they're not willing to do the homework themselves to research something that takes 15 minutes to get your BMI calculation, find out how many calories you need, and then adjust some macros according to those caloric, you know, requirements. So maybe part of it is just, I want to look like that person. That person looks that way. So whatever they're doing had worked for them. So why can't I do the same thing? And what's funny to me is, so let's take this into the realm of weightlifting. You'll have people that are outside of weightlifting community writing books and articles about weightlifting related things that have really no proven facts or anything like that. Like using bands with weightlifting on pulls is, sure, you can, but saying that that's your method, that you came up with that, is probably not true, because, well, I've seen other people use it before you. So,
well, and that's a good example of a red flag in the weightlifting scenario, is when somebody says that they have a new thing, they probably don't.
Yeah. Yeah, because training's been very similar for the past 100 years. Like, it really, I don't think, why would you reinvent the wheel? You know, I'm all for trying new things, but if all these things that people have been doing up to this point have worked in the past to make elite level weightlifters, why are you trying to throw crazy, you know, chain banded exercises into the routine and saying that you're going to create an elite weightlifter that way?
Yeah, I think that, you know, part of the, again, going back to our constant griping about social media, is that if you want people to follow you and think that you're cool, you got to put out some stuff that looks kind of crazy. And, you know, because it's not as, you know, marketable to say, we do the fundamentals and we do the things that have been proven over time, you know, periodization and, you know, some exercise variety, but not so much variety that you're never practicing the full lifts.
Right.
It just doesn't sound as cool as, here's my new extreme shoulder program, or my new get your pull to your eyes program, or my new technique for the snatch, where, you know, these things are pretty well established.
Yeah.
And if you look at what, you know, the best coaches in the country, those senior international coaches, they have slight differences in how long they want to push strength cycles. They have slight differences in their exercises they pick to correct certain movement issues or strength imbalances. But if you look at a program from any of those guys, you're going to see similar stuff. You're going to see a logical progression in weight every week. You're going to see a periodic deload. You're going to see variety centered around correcting things. And yeah, it's just, it's not, there's not a whole lot of fancy new things coming out. So people try to make these things up because it gets them a lot of Instagram followers.
Yeah.
But I'd say, you know, if you're looking for coaching or wondering if you should follow the advice of somebody, you know, you got to look at what have they done as an athlete. You know, like, 'cause there's a lot of, you know, professional weightlifters offering advice and technique stuff on Instagram. So you got to look at what they did as an athlete, but also, you know, have they, you know, brought people up from, you know, like taught them well and then coached them, because that's another option, because you don't have to be a great weightlifter.
And there's plenty of coaches that don't have, you know, this level of stardom, right, at any, you know, athletic level, but they're good coaches. They know how to work with people. They know how to program for people. They've got a very good coaching eye. And so being a good athlete isn't an indicator of someone being a good coach. And a good coach doesn't always have to be a great athlete. And I've seen that happen in more than one sport, to where somebody's a great athlete, but then they turn around and try to coach a team or try to coach, you know, other athletes, and it's just like, they're just not suited for it.
Well, what I think makes it hard, you know, for people that are very talented is if they didn't really struggle to figure it out, then it's going to be hard for them to help someone that is really struggling to figure it out.
Yeah.
I think I might have heard Greg Everett say this on some podcast, but the question was essentially like, well, if you're looking for a new club or a new coach, how do you decide, you know, which to go with? And their response was, well, if you're looking for someone who can help you get to a national level, look for coaches that have helped other people get to that level. Like, go to the, you know, if you're looking at a club, go to the start list from last year's American Open and see if anybody from that club is there.
Yeah, that's true.
Because if that's your goal, then they can help you if they've done it before. If your goal is to do local meets, don't join a barbell club that doesn't compete.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, exactly. Because
there are, you know, certain CrossFit gyms and stuff that will have weightlifting class or weightlifting time, but they don't have an organized schedule of competitions they're going to do every year. They don't travel to meets. So if you want to travel to AO Series meets, try to find a club where your coach will go with you, right, because that's an important part of deciding that. So I think that that's, so looking at, you know, who the person you're taking advice from has helped in the past, and you know, what their kind of approach is, and if they're, you know, is it they're offering tips and advice to sell t-shirts, or are they offering tips and advice because they like coaching?
Right.
You know, because whenever, you know, people end up, whenever you're selling something, things sometimes get lost within that.
And one thing that I do like, and both Greg Everett and Danny Camargo kind of do this. Greg Everett, he writes material for weightlifting related
things, he writes so much.
And he writes a lot, but it's all good stuff. It's always something that was like, I didn't either think about it, or I think about it in a new way because of the way he expressed it. But one thing that Daniel Camargo used to do, and maybe he still does occasionally, but he'll ask a question, like a coaching question, and say, hey, in this video, this person did this thing, and then it was corrected. He's like, what was the correction? Or, you know, something to that effect. Like, there was a problem, how would you correct it? And then here's the what happens when the correction is implemented. And then he'll give it a, you know, let it boil for a few hours until people start answering, and then he'll give the answer and have some discussion on whatever, you know, if it's an Instagram post. But I like that kind of stuff because he's not trying to sell you anything. He's just trying to educate the weightlifting community or anybody who would be interested in general. And I think a lot of the time, people, they try to go after the people at the top, right? For advice, for anything. But Tim Ferriss, he said some of the best people to seek information and knowledge from are the people that got second and third place in a lot of stuff. Because oftentimes they work just as hard as the person that won first. They just didn't get lucky, or they didn't have that tiny edge of whatever it was in competition that would have allowed them to win. Because a lot of time, it's pretty close. I mean, we talked about last week how at Worlds, Muhammad Ihab Yusuf and Lu Zhaojun, I mean,
1 kilo, right?
Yeah, 1 kilo. He lost by a kilo in one of the lifts, and then by 2 kilos on another, and by 2 kilos on the total, something like that. But I'm sure they both trained just as hard. They trained, you know, just as long. They're doing the same exercises. You know, and one just had a better day than the other. You know?
Yeah, I think there is something to that, you know, where sometimes the people that are putting in a lot of hard work and really working on spending their time coaching and working with athletes and just making that their priority aren't always the same people that have their priorities as, you know, social media marketing.
Right.
Or, you know, trying to really promote themselves because they're busy, you know, doing the work day to day.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of really great coaches that, you know, you don't always hear a ton from. And they're just because they're not as, you know, a lot of them are still, you know, working other jobs or, you know, doing that on the side, and but they have, you know, years and years of experience. Or maybe, you know, people forget about coaches that were dominant for years and years and years, and maybe they don't have athletes right now, but they're not getting the attention that the, you know, up and coming folks are getting. So if you're, you know, looking around on the internet and trying to determine whether or not the advice that you're getting is practical, you know, if you want to evaluate that person before you evaluate what your opinion of that input is, you know, you want to look at what sort of education background that person's got, what they've actually done, who yeah. they've actually helped. 'Cause there's some people that, you know, can just generate buzz and do seminars, but when you look at their record, they've never coached anyone there at a meet.
Yeah.
And that's sort of an important part.
Well, so if somebody is starting out coaching and maybe they do have the potential to get athletes to, you know, a high level, they have good ideas, they have, you know, a solid knowledge base, they just don't have the coaching experience that they need to attract more athletes. Sometimes athletes have to take a chance on a coach too.
Yeah.
Like, because the thing is their American weightlifting hasn't been that popular until recently. And we have some other, you know, fitness modalities that have contributed to the growth of weightlifting. But I don't think that the American coaches have lacked anything that any other country has had. We are just as knowledgeable. We have just as many great athletes. Our training facilities were really good. You know, before they closed the Olympic Training Center, it was pretty fantastic, like, yeah, facility and place to train at. And I think that if you can't get to some of these coaches, then try to find one close to you that is trying to build a barbell club, that is trying to, you know, create a good community, and take a chance on them. And you'll know if they're trying to make you, you know, squat jerk the first day, it's probably not the best barbell club, you know, to try to join. But if they start with, hey, we're not going to put any weight on the bar, I just want to evaluate your movement. We might even just work with the PVC pipe today. We're going to check out how far you can squat down, what your range of motion is. You know, can you keep the bar overhead in, you know, this position? You know, where does your strength and your deficiencies show up? And it goes back to that nutrition thing, right? I mean, you'll know if people aren't asking you questions or trying to run you through fundamentals, then maybe that's not such a good option. But if they want to break down your technique, if you're already a great lifter or you're already, you know, been lifting for a long time, they might not have to make a lot of adjustments or fix a whole lot of those basics. But it's still not bad to run through them and make sure that everything that you need to do is there to continue building on.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that, you know, with the nutrition thing and, you know, the weightlifting thing, and I guess we're focusing on those two because they're the most kind of marketed things that you're after. There's like 1,000 online weightlifting teams, and there's 1,000 online nutritionists. And I think, you know, if you're looking for someone in person, like the big thing is going to be, you know, honesty about something. So if, you know, you're talking to someone and you mention that you've got a hip rotation, if you're a coach and you don't know how exactly to address that issue, you need to say, I'm going to look into that and do some research and get back to you, rather than just fake it and tell them that they're fine.
Yeah.
You know, you need to be, as a coach or someone who offers nutrition advice, you need to make sure that you're not overrepresenting yourself.
Yeah.
You know, so if, you know, somebody that, you know, has been to 3 Olympics comes to our gym, I'd be like, well, I'm happy to help you, but I have never done this before.
Yeah.
You know, like, don't like oversell yourself.
Right.
But, you know, I think it's good to let people have a chance, because, I mean, I've been lucky in that. I've had a lot of people, you know, give me chances to help them with nutrition or with weightlifting. But I like to think that, you know, it's always a, hey, this has worked in the past. Here's some kind of information about why this sort of diet can work. But let's try it and see if it works for you. And it might not, yeah. You know. Or, hey, we're going to do this training program because I want to try to make this happen. But then be honest with yourself. You say, I'm sorry, that just it didn't work out. It might have been too much for you, so we're going to change this. So yeah. Not, you know, insisting that being able to admit when something that you made didn't work the way that you wanted.
Yeah.
You know, really being, you know, you want somebody that's introspective. You want someone that's thinking about what they're doing.
Right.
Another good evaluation for any coach or nutritionist, if you're talking to them and wanting help, is pick something specific, whether it's an exercise or a number of carbs you're getting or a food item on the list that's excluded. Ask them why. And if somebody doesn't have a why to every single thing that they've told you to do, if the answer is just because I said so, that's kind of another red flag, you know, yeah. Where you want to be working with someone that is conscious about what they're doing and is constantly evaluating how that's going and is willing to change things if they're not working, rather than saying, well, it must be something you're doing.
Right. And a lot of the time people have a mentality, and I have this towards certain things too. You get what you pay for, right? And cheap doesn't always equal good, and good doesn't equal cheap. But if somebody is overselling themselves as good, but they're giving you a cheap product, then that's obviously what you want to avoid as well. So usually when you come across things, they'll be reasonably priced. I know a lot of like online coaches, people that are offering a lot of these programs, especially the elite athlete ones, like the seminar people, it's like $175 a month to get your own, you know, 4-week program from some of these guys. If you show up to a 2-day seminar, you're paying like $200, and you spend maybe, you know, 4 hours, 5 hours on for 2 days with them. And I mean, how much can you absorb? You try to learn as much as you can, but you know, you have these people that maybe competed 2 or 3 times at nationals, and then all of a sudden they're advertising seminars on how to snatch and clean and jerk. It's a little bit like, I mean, they're trying to get people because of what they've done without having a huge knowledge base or a lot of expertise to offer in the realms of coaching and giving and transferring their knowledge to people that haven't done it at that level before.
Yeah, I think that tied into that is the problem that people end up feeling like a seminar is not the same as expertise. A seminar or a certification is a baseline. So the USAW level 1, that doesn't mean that you're really that you're already a good coach.
Yeah.
It gives you the things you need to do to start developing. the level two gives you those things that are, okay, here's the next level of development stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, no matter where you are on the spectrum of coaching, if you think of it as, I took the class and I'm done now, you're doing a disservice to your athletes. So, like, looking for that when you're kind of evaluating who you're getting advice from, is it, you know, oh, I have the end-all be-all for this.
Right.
Because, I mean, I'm a national coach, so I've got my USAW level 3, but I can tell you that, you know, I did learn good stuff in the level 1 and the level 2, but the difference between what you learn in those and what you have to do to actually produce people and develop them from the ground to a national competition, there's a lot more to that. And if you're not reading and listening to interviews and, like, paying attention to what, you know, the best coaches in the country are doing and trying to learn from them,
right,
then, you know, you're not really furthering your expertise in any one area. And yeah, I think that if people admit that they are, like, say that they're an expert, like, I would never say that I'm an expert in weightlifting. I'm getting pretty good, and I'm able to help people out, but I'm going to be learning new things the entire time I'm doing this.
Yeah.
You know, every time you run somebody through a cycle, there's, oh, okay, that was really interesting that that happened. I wonder why. Or, oh, that worked really well. We'll keep that. You know, you're always evaluating. And I think, beware of people that say they have all the answers.
Yeah, for sure. I think, and I've asked Grayson this before, I'll try to find a way just to be a better coach. And, like, how do I do that? How do I continue my education as a coach? And a lot of it just comes down to reading, continuing to be interested, finding the nuances of, you know, how to make people better. And, you know, just listen to podcasts, listen to other people talk about weightlifting, watch weightlifting videos. And, you know, to develop a coach's eye and to be able to spot problems and troubleshoot, you pretty much just have to watch a lot of weightlifting, a lot of it. And so for the USAW, the level one is fundamentals. They're teaching you a little more about weightlifting so that you can help teach other people about weightlifting. But you're not an expert at teaching weightlifting, and you're not an expert on the movement yourselves. And then the level two is, once those people want to compete, then how do you run their cards? Like, how do you program for them at a higher level? How do you deal with athletes on a personal level and things like that? So it's a little bit psychology based, some programming methodology, as well as, you know, the actual day of meets. How do you make those things flow smoothly? But none of those things made me ready to run cards and, you know, train athletes and coach other athletes at those types of meets. It was just doing it.
Yeah,
it's, and doing it over and over again. Yeah, it's like, now I can look at the board and I know how many lifts my lifter is going to be out, anticipate potential changes that might cause them to be jumped up in the list and go maybe cut a few of their warm-ups short. And I know if they're at the beginning, where they should be at time-wise, leading up to the first attempts. So, but that doesn't come from, oh, I just went to a level two, you know, USA weightlifting class. I had to be there. I had to go through that and make some mistakes. And I have done that. And I'll probably make some more, hopefully, that won't cost athletes anything, but something that I'll learn from and say, oh, I'm not doing that again. And
that's what we've been practicing is, you know, this whole year, whenever we're going to these meets together, we've developed our backroom routine where we're double checking the count for each other. We're helping the athlete warm up while one person pays attention to the board and makes sure that we're not getting jumped or it keeps us apprised of time changes, and figuring out those backroom dynamics and how to approach different athletes with different mindsets. You can get glimpses into those through your seminars, but it's no substitute for just spending time with people and trying to get them better and taking them to competitions.
Yeah.
So if you're, you know, getting YouTube advice about what to do for competitions, make sure that person's helped other people at competitions.
Yeah, for sure. In a seminar, sometimes, and I've been to a few, and you know what it's like? It's like paying a celebrity to hang out with them for 2 days for a couple hours. It's like, all right, well, we're going to hang out and do this thing you like to do because I like to do it too, and I'm going to try to learn what I can from you. So that's what it seems like a lot of the time. So unless it's in a classroom setting where they're sitting down, they're instructing you and then showing you practical applications, it's more or less you're just going to hang out with them. They're going to coach you a little bit, and you're going to give them whatever amount of money, and they're going to move on to the next city.
Yeah. I think that there's definitely, you know, some seminars that are just like a weightlifting exhibition and then a little bit of drilling.
Yeah.
If anybody listening is a coach and kind of looking for like a really, really good quality seminar, Ursula Garza puts on just a really, really great coaching seminar called The Art of Coaching Weightlifting. That one is phenomenal. It's some practical stuff and a little bit of lifting. But she's written, you know, a book with her kind of info and progressions into it. But there's so much open dialogue and open question and answer time and good, like, theoretical weightlifting foundations that are a little bit different than what you'll get in the USAW courses. And what's great about it is the asking questions is you can really dive in and find out exactly what you want to know.
Yeah.
So if you guys are looking for a good coaching seminar, hers is definitely good. Well, so I think that kind of covers our gist of it. Mainly, just look at the words people use to describe themselves, look at what they've actually done, and then how thorough are they being with their assessment of you, just to kind of keep you from burning your wheels, because there's so much good information out there, but there's also a lot of bad information.
Yeah.
So I thought for today's philosophy corner, rather than having a really kind of in-depth question, I more so wanted to talk about how each of us ended up getting into philosophy in general and kind of what led us down this path to where this is something of interest to us. And we've never really talked about this. So yeah. When did you start getting into philosophy? When did you first start thinking about these sort of things?
Well, I first started at 25, and I kind of had, it's not a midlife crisis, but I had an existential crisis.
A quarter life crisis,
but it was an existential crisis, and it was just like, what am I doing with my life? Like, am I doing the stuff that really matters, or am I just going through the motions? Because like, I was married, I had kids already. I had the white picket fence and the car and the dog and, you know, the whole life that a lot of people used to glamorize. And it was just, it was okay. You know, I was just existing. And it's not that I didn't love my family or, you know, it's not that I wasn't willing to do what I needed to do to provide for them and you know, make everything work. It's just that there was this underlying sense of a lack of meaning to it. It was like, oh, well, this is it, right? This is me now. Like, this is as good as it gets. And so I kind of had to go through some counseling just to talk to somebody else outside of, you know, my family at the time, because they couldn't understand, you know. So I ended up getting this book. It's called Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl. And that book really changed the way I looked at stuff. Viktor Frankl was a Holocaust survivor. He had survived one of the most horrifying experiences I've ever read about. And it dawned on me that people, everybody suffers, right? But we all suffer in our own way. Suffering is relative. If you've only known, you know, pumpkin spice lattes and UGG boots and driving a, you know, a Mercedes your whole life, if your life downgrades from that, you're gonna suffer. Even if if it's just a little bit, like somebody else's okay is somebody else's hell.
It's definitely true.
So I just kind of started to think about thinking and how I thought about things and what mattered. And sometimes I wouldn't come to a perfect conclusion, but a lot of times I'd say, well, why do I think about this way? It was like not self-diagnosis, but just self-reflection. And the more I started to do that, the more I started to look into, you know, thought processes and not self-improvement, but like self-optimization. Like, how can I be better? Not so I can gloat or hold it over anybody's head, but just to make my life better. And if my life was terrible, how do I just think about it a different way? Because if I can find the meaning, even in the most intense suffering, then I've accomplished a good thing for myself. And that's kind of how I got into it. And then I started reading like a lot of books about Stoicism, and I like Stoicism a lot. It's not really I know a lot of people think it's that drab, monotone, not caring about anything, this emotionless robot type thing, but that's not what Stoicism is. It's a system of thought. It's a way of thinking about the world and detaching yourself from outcomes and emotions and your ego, and just realizing that a lot of life is about the choices that you make, and taking responsibility for those choices, and the things that happen aren't always in your control, but you can choose how you can react to them, what you think about them, and how you go forward.
That's really interesting. So you mainly kind of had these questions start arising, and you know, you did mostly some reading to kind of help kind of flush those ideas out. What do you think? What was like one of the first things you really read that was, you know, still helpful? Like, what's something that you always go back to?
One of them was Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance.
I haven't actually read that.
It's by Michael M. Persig, and one of the things that he says in there is the answers are always simple, but they're only simple when you already know what they are. It's the hard part is coming to those answers and figuring them out. And I always go back to it because it's like this journey with himself, and he constantly evaluates things. So like, let's say the word quality, right? Like this thing has quality. It's quality made. Quality, it's a quality product. It's a quality experience. But what exactly does quality mean? Does it have a standard definition? Like, how do you decide what's of quality? And is it the same thing to you as it is to me? What's a quality life? When people give you surveys, like, how was the quality of the service? Like, what does that mean? Is it good or bad? Did it meet your expectations? That's an attachment. Expectations are an attachment. It's something that you wanted to happen.
Yeah.
So, like, one of those words, another one is good and evil, right? Good and evil are words that we use to describe situations that didn't happen the way we wanted to or did. Like, if it happened and it made us happy and, you know, it made us feel a certain way, it was a good experience. But if something went wrong, you know, it rained on this day we were out on vacation and we had this huge plan for a picnic and it just, you know, it was terrible. A bear chased us in the woods. Like, that wasn't, it was a bad experience. Like, you know, so we attach these words like good and bad and quality, but they don't have a real meaning. It's just like success. Success doesn't have a specific meaning. It's relative to what you think success is. So I started with that book, I started to think about those kinds of things. Like, we attach meaning to these words and society uses them, but they're very vague. So I started to think about, well, what do these things mean to me and how should I think about them? And should I think about them? Do they matter? So that's one of the books, like Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, kind of helped me think about thinking and how to approach things in a different way. And sometimes words are used against us a lot of times in marketing and advertising, and we just buy them as they are, and we don't really look into or think about how those words are really, how they're being portrayed.
That's a good point, man. Like, I think, you know, there's so many and so much of really looking at philosophy is you have to be very clear with what you mean by words, because, you know, just saying that something is good, you have to really be specific. And that's one thing that I really love about it, is that it kind of makes you break down and say, well, what does that really mean? I don't, like, what is, you know, more than, beyond the dictionary definition, like, what is, you know, the context of this word, and can it be different depending on the situation? I started to get into philosophy mostly through kind of political philosophy. I went through a phase in, I think, you know, early eighth grade, where I was, you know, really into reading about anarchism and, you know, read some Marx and Engels and barely understood it, but thought it was really interesting, and just kind of about what should society be structured like, and kind of really questioning, like, well, is the way that we're doing things now really the best way? And I kind of drifted away from that, but my first kind of, the philosophers that kind of speak to me the most are the existential philosophers. And the reason being is that I kind of was confronted with that, the reality of what, you know, our world is pretty young. When I was in eighth grade, my best friend died of an opiate overdose. And he was in he just finished his ninth grade year. So losing him at that age, I really kind of spiraled a little bit and had a few kind of hard years where I was getting arrested a lot or getting into a lot of trouble, just because it really seemed like if something that random and unfair can happen to somebody that's 15, you know, it's like, well, what's really going on here? And after a couple of years of just kind of floundering and just thinking that everything was kind of worthless, I made friends with a guy who was a couple years older than me. So I was a junior when he was starting his freshman year of college, and he was studying philosophy. And so we'd talk about kind of what he was reading, and he'd kind of send me some articles every now and then. And, you know, so he kind of started getting me into, you know, starting to question, like, okay, well, what are the basis of ethics? Like, what are the ways that we could determine that things are good or bad? And is that really a subjective thing? And how can you attach meaning to things that are just seemingly so random? And unfortunately, he also committed suicide right before I deployed to Afghanistan. So in memory of him, I kind of read a bunch of these philosophy books while I was out there. And I read a little bit of some Nietzsche and The Will to Power. And I actually found, when I was out in Afghanistan, a copy of a book called Sophie's World.
Okay.
Which I think is maybe kind of written for a young adult audience, but it's a really kind of cool story that's like a novelization of the history of philosophy. So it was really easy to follow, but it starts with Plato and kind of moves through all the modern philosophers. And that was where I started really kind of like understanding the lineage and the history behind the things that my friend Jeff and I would talk about. And so really learning about those things is a way to kind of, you know, try to understand kind of what he did and why he did that. And to kind of, you know, pursue those interests, like, kind of for him. And, you know, as I kind of got into listening to more podcasts, there's a ton of really good philosophy podcasts out there. If you want something short and concise, Philosophize This has a really good, you know, 25-30 minute history starting from the Greeks all the way up. The Partially Examined Life is awesome, as well as Very Bad Wizards. And, you know, so I've been, you know, consuming a lot of this, you know, Sam Harris and Richard Dawkins, and listening to, you know, these guys talk about ethics. And that's kind of what really kind of burdened my interest. And the more I kind of carry on and the more I read, and it's just, it gives a lot of depth, you know. It's like you were talking about, where you're really kind of starting to examine things. And I feel like it's really helped, you know, not just go through the motions. You know, if you're really evaluating it, because I, for so long, I was just so angry all the time. And I just had this kind of like, I don't know if it was that I felt the world was unfair, or I was just too much testosterone and not a positive outlet to go through. But, you know, learning that if you're feeling angry, you don't have to. You can try to take a step back and say, all right, well, why am I mad about this? Right. Why am I upset today? And, you know, a lot of times, like, it just comes back to what I've found is that it's insecurity. If you're, you know, angry, it's probably because there's something you're insecure about. You're not sure of yourself. You don't really know yourself, or you're scared of something.
Right.
And, you know, learning to analyze your emotions, or to take a step back and really think about, why are you reacting the way that you are? Why is that the correct thing to do? Or just, are you happy doing what you're doing? Like, what do you want out of this whole right. thing? And taking control of that, I feel like this is super useful, you know? And as it can also be fun, you know? Like, philosophy doesn't have to always be super serious, you know? Like, it's be the guy at a party that asks, you know, how do you know you're not a brain in a vat?
Yeah.
You know? Like, how do you know that this isn't a hallucination?
This is
you
a
know?
Simulation.
Yeah. Is this a simulation? Can you prove that it isn't? And, you know, just, it gives you insights into your own life. But it also, I think, can help spur on more meaningful conversations with the people around you. You know, if you're having some fun with it and you're kind of getting into the nitty gritty of it's like, well, what do you mean by good?
Right.
Yeah. You know, if you're doing some Socratic method of, you know, like, well, what is beauty? Is it, you know, in the eye of the beholder, or is it objective? And, you know, some of these like classic ancient discussions are really just fun to have with your friends.
I agree.
And fun to think about. And, you know, in my other job, spend a lot of time just kind of driving around, and it's like, well, I mean, I'd rather drive around thinking about stuff.
I agree.
Yeah, so that's kind of how I ended up there. It was, you know, starting with, you know, some of that, you know, eighth grade trauma and just kind of the backlash of that, and then trying to process that and pull myself together into a, you know, functional adult human being. It was super helpful. So that's kind of where my background came from there. And going forward, I mean, there's so much to learn about this stuff, and as we learn more, we'll discuss more on this podcast.
Yeah.
And I think that tying it together with weightlifting makes sense to me.
Yeah, it makes sense to me too. And I know a lot of these ideas come from philosophers that lived a very long time ago, and I don't think there's wrong with adapting them to the way things are today. Some of them are practical just as much as they were back then, because humans haven't really changed. We're still very similar. We still have the same problems with friendships and finances and careers and the influences of the world around us. So a lot of those things carry over because it hasn't changed. We still all deal with it.
It's amazing how little it's changed.
Yeah.
I just recently listened to the audiobook of, is it Seneca on Meditations on the Shortness of Life?
Yes, that's Seneca.
Yeah, and it's amazing that the things written by this guy in the Roman Empire are 100% the exact same things that we're dealing with today.
Right.
Like, off-putting reward and saying, I have to focus on my career, and then when I retire, I can finally relax and be happy. And nobody actually ends up being able to do that.
Nope.
And it's so crazy that these are the exact same struggles that people have today. That, oh, I'll get to enjoy my life once I do this.
Right.
Once I accomplish this. And I think that, you know, there's wisdom in all those traditions, and it's way more applicable today than you think it would be.
I absolutely agree.
All right, guys. Well, go ahead and check out any of those philosophy podcasts, read some books, send us a question, asaweightlifting@gmail.com. Go ahead and like and review the podcast. That's a big help to us. And until next week.
All right, y'all. Happy lifting.